There were also captives taken on the battlefield or at sea. Some of these Western visitors entered the service of Muslim governments. In the Western perspective, they were adventurers and renegades. For the Muslims, they were muqtadi, those who have found and followed the true path. The 18th century brought an entirely new category of Western visitors, whom we might describe in modern parlance as experts. Some came as individuals to offer their services to Ottoman employers. Later, some were even seconded by their governments as part of an increasingly popular type of arrangement between a Christian or post-Christian country on the one hand and the Ottoman or some other Muslim state on the other. Such arrangements continue to the present day. For Muslims, first in Turkey and later elsewhere, this brought a shocking new idea that one might learn from the previously despised infidel. An even more shocking innovation was travel from east to west. Previously, only captives and a very limited number of special diplomatic envoys had gone that way. Muslims had no holy places in Europe to visit as pilgrims, as Christians visited the Holy Land. There was not much to attract merchants in a Europe that, for many centuries, was still a relatively primitive place with little to offer. The most valued commodity brought from Europe to the East were slaves, and these were usually supplied by Muslim raiders or European merchants. Muslims were no strangers to travel. The pilgrimage to Mecca was one of the five basic obligations of the faith, and required Muslims, at least once in a lifetime, to make the necessary journey, however long it might be. Muslims also travelled extensively in the countries to the south and to the east of the realms of Islam, in search of merchandise or knowledge. The lands and peoples beyond the northwestern frontier of Islam had little to offer of either, and such travel was in fact actively discouraged by the doctors of the holy law. Western captives in the east, who escaped or were ransomed and returned home, produced a considerable literature telling of their adventures, of the lands they had seen, and the people they had met in the mysterious Orient. Middle Eastern captives in the West who found their way home, for the most part, remained silent, nor was there any great interest in the few accounts that survived. The Occident remained even more mysterious than the Orient, and it aroused no equivalent curiosity. The different mutual perceptions were vividly expressed in their attitudes to each other's languages. The study of Eastern languages was intensively pursued in the European universities and elsewhere by scholars who came to be known as Orientalists, on the analogy of Hellenists and Latinists. Until a comparatively recent date, there were no Occidentalists in the Orient. The European powers had long followed the practice of maintaining permanent resident embassies and consulates in the Islamic lands as elsewhere. The Islamic governments did not. It was the normal practice of Muslim sovereigns to send an ambassador to a foreign ruler when there was something to say, and to bring him home when he had said it. This eminently sensible and economical practice was maintained for centuries. Until the 18th century, there were very few such missions, and very few indications survive of what they reported. In the 18th century, the situation changed dramatically. Great numbers of such special envoys were now sent, with instructions to observe and to learn, and, more particularly, to report on anything that might be useful to the Muslim state in coping with its difficulties and confronting its enemies. Several of the Ottoman ambassadors wrote reports, which clearly had a considerable impact at the time. Among them were Mehmet Efendi, who went to Paris in 1721, Resmi Efendi, who went to Vienna in 1757, and to Berlin in 1773, Vasif Efendi, who was in Madrid from 1787 to 1789, Azmi Efendi, who was in Berlin from 1790 to 1792, and wrote an interesting memorandum on how a well-ordered state is governed and administered, and in many ways, most important of all, Ebu Bekir Ratib Efendi, who was in Vienna from 1791 to 1792, and described the system of civil and military government in the Austrian Empire in great detail, with specific recommendations concerning those practices that might usefully be copied. The mission of Ratib Effendi differs from those of his predecessors, both in quantity and in quality. The staff who accompanied him to Vienna consisted of more than 100 military and civil officials. He stayed in Vienna for 153 days. His report ran to 245 manuscript folios, 10 times or more than 10 times those of his predecessors, and it goes into immense detail, primarily on military matters, but also, to quite a considerable extent, on civil affairs. Ratib Effendi also took the trouble to provide himself with much-needed help on the language side. In his report, he mentions two people who had been particularly helpful to him. One was the son of the Jewish financier, Commando, one of the small group of Ottoman Sephardic Jews who were living in Austria. The other was the famous Murad Gea Doson, an Ottoman Armenian, who had long served as translator to the Swedish embassy in Istanbul. In his retirement, he had gone to live in Paris, but because of the revolution, had moved to Vienna. These two provided much more than simple translation. Ratib Effendi, in his report, tells of Murad Gea Doson's visits and long conversations with him, and notes that the Armenian zeal for the Ottoman state was at least as great as his own. The recourse to Vienna was less surprising than it might at first appear. Events in France were bringing an important change. For almost three centuries, the Ottoman sultans had seen the Habsburgs as their main enemies, and had looked to France and to a lesser extent to England for help against them. But the revolution in France created a new situation. The new sultan, Selim III, reigned 1789 to 1807, was clearly reluctant to drop the French connection, but the events in Paris obliged him to explore other possibilities, even the traditional enemy. As well as embassy reports, there were also military memoranda. One of the earliest pieces of evidence, mentioned above, records an imaginary conversation between an Ottoman officer and a Christian officer, comparing their armies to the great disadvantage of the Ottomans. The purpose, clearly, was to prepare the Ottoman governing elite for drastic changes. This was bad enough in itself. That the changes should take the form of following Western practice was even more shocking. A major role in this process was played by European experts. Some of these came as individuals, and threw in their lot completely with the Ottomans, to the point of embracing Islam and entering the Ottoman service. One such was a French nobleman, Claude Alexandre Comte de Bonneval, who arrived in about 1729, reorganized the bombardier force, and founded a mathematical school for the armed forces in 1734. He converted to Islam, allegedly to escape extradition on certain charges pending against him at home, and died in 1747. He is known in Turkish annals as Bombardier Ahmed, Humbarachi Ahmed. Another famous convert was a Hungarian seminarist, probably Unitarian, known in Turkish annals as Ibrahim Muteferika. Ibrahim's original family name is unknown. Muteferika is a title, indicating membership of a kind of elite guard corps attached to the sultan's person. He seems to have arrived in the late 17th century and died in 1745. His major achievement was to establish a Turkish printing press in 1729. One of the books he printed was a short treatise of his own, in which he explains the successes of Christian arms against the Ottomans in Europe and urges the need to reform Ottoman administrative and military procedures along European lines. As well as converts to Islam, there were a number of refugees who came from Europe, bringing useful skills. These included Christians whose beliefs were deemed heretical or schismatic in their countries of origin, and of course, Jews. For a while in the late 15th and more especially in the 16th centuries, Jewish refugees from Europe played a minor but not unimportant role in Ottoman society, bringing European economic, technical, and medical skills, and occasionally serving in diplomatic missions. But with the cessation of Jewish immigration from Europe, this virtually came to an end. Those who came from Europe had brought useful skills and knowledge. Their locally born descendants lacked these advantages, and their role was correspondingly diminished. Of vastly greater importance were the Greeks. In the early years of Ottoman rule in the former Byzantine lands, there was great bitterness among the Orthodox Greeks at their treatment by the Catholic West, and the Patriarch of Constantinople was famously quoted as saying, "Rather the turban of the Turk than the tiara of the Pope." But attitudes changed, and from the late 17th century, it became customary for wealthy Greek families in the Turkish lands to send their sons to Europe, usually to Italy, for education. They particularly favored medical studies, but also began to play an influential role as translators for the Ottoman government. The office of interpreter to the Ottoman authorities was, of course, important in dealings with Europe. In earlier times, it was held mostly by renegades and adventurers from the countries bordering the Ottoman Empire, Germans, Hungarians, Italians, and others. Later, it was monopolized by Greek subjects of the Ottoman state, who held the office and title of Grand Dragoman. The role of the Grand Dragoman Alexander Mavrokordato in the negotiation of the Treaty of Karlovitz was an important, but by no means exceptional, example. At this time, when the Ottomans sent an ambassador abroad, he was invariably accompanied by a dragoman, who was almost invariably Greek. By the late 18th century, the Ottoman state no longer needed to rely for its military reforms on renegades and adventurers, but could request and obtain the seconding of experts from European countries. One of the first and most important was the Baron de Tott, an officer of Hungarian origin in the French service, who spent some time in Turkey in the 1770s, when he founded a new school of mathematics, and contributed significantly to the training of the Ottoman forces in the new sciences of military engineering and artillery. On his retirement in 1775, he was replaced as chief instructor by a British officer, who later converted to Islam, and who was known after his conversion as Inglis Mustafa. Since his original name was Campbell, his Turkish sobriquet seems doubly incongruous. The dominant European influence, however, remained French, and most of the foreign instructors were either French or taught in the French language, the study of which was made compulsory for all students in the new military and naval schools. In 1789, a year of some significance in France, a new sultan, Selim III, ascended the throne of Osman. He had long been interested in reform, and had even corresponded, while still heir apparent, with the French king, Louis XVI. He now embarked on an extensive program of military and administrative reform and reconstruction. At first, the sultan, undeterred by the changes in France, turned to Paris for help. The Committee of Public Safety, and later the Directoire, responded. French-Ottoman cooperation was briefly interrupted by the Franco-Ottoman War of 1798 to 1802, but was later resumed, only to be interrupted again when Napoleon made peace with the Tsar at Turkish expense. The Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, involving the whole of Europe, extended to Africa, and more especially to Asia, through the encounters there between the European colonial powers. The relative weakness of the major Islamic powers had already, in a sense, been revealed by the first European expansion in Asia, when even small countries like Portugal and the Netherlands were able to establish themselves on the seas and on the coasts, in defiance of the Muslim powers. The impotence of the Islamic world confronted with Europe was brought home in dramatic form in 1798, when a French expeditionary force commanded by a young general called Napoleon Bonaparte invaded, occupied, and governed Egypt. The lesson was harsh and clear. Even a small European force could invade one of the heartlands of the Islamic Empire and do so with impunity. The second lesson came a few years later, when the French were forced to leave, not by the Egyptians, nor by their Turkish suzerains, but by a squadron of the Royal Navy, commanded by a young admiral called Horatio Nelson. This lesson, too, was clear. Not only could a European power come and act at will, but only another European power could get them out. The message was repeated with new emphasis in 1807, and this time nearer home. Between 1806 and 1812, Turkey fought a major war against Russia. Britain was at first involved as an ally of Russia against Napoleon, and in February 1807, a British naval squadron commanded by Admiral Duckworth forced its way through the Dardanelles and threatened Istanbul. In this campaign, the boot was on the other foot. While the Sultan engaged the admiral in interminable negotiations, his men, directed by the French ambassador Sebastiani, rebuilt and strengthened the fortifications of the city so effectively that the British admiral was obliged to withdraw. But in July of the same year, Napoleon, to free himself for his war against England, made a deal with the Tsar at Tilsit, and was now ready to sacrifice Turkey to his new policy. The two emperors' plan for partition of European Turkey gave the Eastern Balkan provinces to Russia, the Western Balkans to France, and assigned parts of Bosnia and Serbia to appease the Austrians. In the ensuing campaign, the Russians crossed the Danube, and by the Treaty of Bucharest of 1812, annexed Bessarabia, today known as Moldova, and acquired extensive rights in the Danubian principalities. Turkey, painfully, was learning the great game, and in time gained some skill in playing it, enough to delay, though not prevent, the final collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Meanwhile, a new force had arisen, which did much to accelerate and finally accomplish that collapse: the rise of the subject peoples within the Ottoman Empire. For many centuries, surprisingly to Western eyes, this was not a problem. The confrontation between Ottoman Islam and European Christendom has often been likened to the Cold War of the second half of the 20th century. There are indeed some similarities between the two confrontations, but also significant differences. Perhaps most notable among these is the movement of refugees. In the 20th century, this movement was, overwhelmingly, from east to west. In the 15th, 16th, and even in the 17th centuries, it was primarily from west to east. Surely, the Ottomans did not offer equal rights to their subjects, a meaningless anachronism in the context of that time and place. They did, however, offer a degree of tolerance without precedent or parallel in Christian Europe. Each religious community, the Ottoman term was millet, was allowed the free practice of its religion. More remarkably, they had their own communal organizations, subject to the authority of their own religious chiefs, controlling their own education and social life, and enforcing their own laws, to the extent that they did not conflict with the basic laws of the empire. While ultimate power, political and military, remained in Muslim hands, non-Muslims controlled much of the economy and were even able to play a part of some importance in the political process. The French Revolution and the arrival of French troops and, more dangerous, French ideas in the Eastern Mediterranean brought a radical change. In February 1804, the Serbs launched their first national rising against the Ottomans, who dealt with it partly by suppression, partly by accommodation. In 1815, a second Serb rising was more successful and won them recognition as an autonomous principality under Ottoman suzerainty. The Greek uprising a few years later evoked widespread European support and achieved a sovereign, independent Greek kingdom. In the course of the 19th and early 20th centuries, the Christian peoples of the Balkans, one by one and step by step, freed themselves from Ottoman rule. Iran, further from the main battlefields of Europe, and lacking both opportunity and skill, was, at this stage, less able than the Turks to play the European powers against one another, and fared even worse. Here, too, the British, the French, and the Russians operated more or less at will, with the Russians taking the lion's share. By the Treaty of Gulistan of 1813, Iran ceded Derbent, Baku, Shirvan, Shaki, Karabakh, and adjoining territories to Russia, and renounced all claim to Georgia, Dagestan, and Mingrelia. A renewal of Russo-Turkish hostilities in 1825 was ended by the Treaty of Turkmanchai of 1828, by which Iran ceded the rest of Armenia to the Russians. The Russian advance against Islam was well underway at the expense of Turkey, Iran, and the Central Asian states. It continued almost to our own day. These wars starkly revealed the weakness of the Muslim states compared with the European powers. Military remedies for military failures were seen and understood to be inadequate. The quest for other causes and other cures began. Chapter 2. The Quest for Wealth and Power. Before the end of the 18th century, Turks, Iranians, and other Middle Easterners had had very little opportunity for direct observation of the West, nothing remotely comparable with the opportunities that Westerners had enjoyed in the East, even in the period when the West was inferior in every material and cultural respect. Contacts occurred mainly in three areas: diplomacy, commerce, and war. But while the European powers from relatively early times maintained offices, then consulates, and eventually embassies in the East, the Eastern powers did not follow this practice, and sent only rare and brief special missions. A similar disparity may be seen in commerce. Western merchants travelled extensively, and on the whole freely, in the Muslim lands. Middle Eastern merchants did not normally travel in the West. Muslims had an extreme reluctance to venture into non-Muslim territory, and the Westerners did not want them to come. When, for example, it was proposed to establish an inn and warehouse for Turkish merchants in Venice, there was a long and anguished debate in the councils of the Venetian state whether or not the Turks should be allowed to build such a center. The importance of the Turkey trade for Venice was obvious, and Venetian merchants were well ensconced in Istanbul and other Turkish cities. But there were strong objections before the proposal was approved. One of the arguments was that this would be even worse than having Jews and Protestants, because, unlike the Jews, the Turks had an army and a navy, and were therefore really dangerous. Sometimes, when the Turks sent one of their emissaries to a European ruler, there would be anxious debates in the country to which he was going, and even in the countries through which he would pass, on whether or not such envoys should be permitted to come or pass. This was by no means an easy or obvious question. On the Muslim side, there was an equal reluctance to go to Europe. The Muslim jurists discuss at some length whether it is permissible for a Muslim to live in a non-Muslim country. They consider the case of the non-Muslim in his own country, or in their terms, the infidel in the land of the infidels, who sees the light and is converted to the true faith. May he stay where he is, or may he not? The general consensus of the classical jurists is no. It is not possible for a Muslim to live a good Muslim life in an infidel land. He must leave home and go to some Muslim country. An even harder case was posed by the reconquest of Spain. If a Muslim land is conquered by the Christians, may they stay under Christian rule? The answer of many jurists was again no, they may not stay. The Moroccan Al-Wansharisi, considering the case of Spain, posed what turned out to be a purely hypothetical question. If the Christian government is tolerant and allows them to practice their religion, may they then stay? His answer was that in that case, it is all the more important for them to leave, because under a tolerant government, the danger of apostasy is greater. The Muslim attitude was different from that of other Eastern civilizations that suffered the impact of the expanding West. For Hindus, Buddhists, Confucians, and others, Christianity and Christendom were new and unknown. Those who came from there, and the things they brought, could therefore be considered more or less on their merits. For Muslims, Christianity, and therefore by implication everything associated with it, was known, familiar, and discounted. Christianity and Judaism were precursors of Islam, with holy books deriving from authentic revelations, but incomplete and corrupted by their unworthy custodians, and therefore superseded by the final and perfect revelation of Islam. What was true in Christianity was incorporated in Islam. What was not so incorporated was false. On the Christian side, there was a similar difference in attitude to the three major Asian civilizations, and for obvious reasons. Neither Indians nor Chinese ruled the Christian Holy Land, nor had they conquered Spain, captured Constantinople, or besieged Vienna. Neither Hindus nor Buddhists nor yet Confucians had ever dismissed the Christian Gospels as corrupt and outdated, and offered a later, better version of God's word to replace them. There were special difficulties in the long encounter between Islam and Christendom that were not present in the encounters between either of these civilizations and the remoter civilizations of Asia. Muslims in general had little desire or incentive to venture into Christian Europe, and indeed, the doctors of the Holy Law for the most part prohibited such journeys, except for a specific and limited purpose. The usual purpose, later the excuse, was to ransom captives. Some, but not all, juristic authorities also permitted travel in infidel lands to purchase supplies in times of shortage. Even among the very small number of people from Middle Eastern countries who ventured into the West for diplomacy or commerce, a significant proportion were not Muslims, but members of the minority religious communities. These were occasionally Jews, more often non-Catholic Christians, Greeks, or Armenians, who were considered to be fairly reliable from an Ottoman point of view. Certainly they could not be suspected of sympathy with the Catholic powers. In these circumstances, it is not surprising that there was virtually no knowledge of Western languages. Only Italian had some currency in the Eastern Mediterranean, and served as a medium of communication between East and West. But even this involved Eastern Christians and Jews, and rarely, if ever, Muslims. Minority doctors with Western training also played an increasing role in the practice of medicine. Arabic, Persian, and Turkish scientific writings of the period show some limited acquaintance with Western medicine and Western geography, both needed for practical reasons, but no awareness of Western history or culture. The discovery of the New World illustrates both points. A Turkish version of Columbus's own, now lost, map, prepared in 1513, survives in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul, where it remained, unconsulted and unknown, until it was discovered by a German scholar in 1929. A Turkish book on the New World was written in the late 16th century, and was apparently based on information from European sources, oral rather than written. It describes the flora, fauna, and inhabitants of the New World, and, of course, expresses the hope that this blessed land would in due course be illuminated by the light of Islam and added to the Sultan's realms. This, too, remained unknown until it was printed in Istanbul in 1729. An unwelcome import from the New World was syphilis, already reported in a Persian medical work by an author who died circa 1510. The disease, which he calls the Frankish pox, came, he said, from Europe, whence its name. It had already reached Azerbaijan before the end of the 15th century. In the prevailing view, the corpus of medical knowledge had reached perfection in the days of Avicenna, and in principle, no change or addition was needed. Indeed, any change or addition was seen by some as impious. But syphilis was new and came from Europe. It was therefore acceptable to translate European writings on the diagnosis and treatment of this disease. A collection of European writings was duly translated and presented to the Sultan. Curiously, though the collection was presented in 1655, it consisted entirely of 16th-century European works. Knowledge was something to be acquired, stored, if necessary bought, rather than grown or developed. Middle Easterners, for practical purposes, had been willing to accept and use such Western devices as cannon and muskets, telescopes and eyeglasses. We have very good historical evidence about that. Under Muslim law, a man or woman has very little discretionary power to dispose of his or her property to heirs. Property had to be divided according to certain rules, which in the classical Ottoman Empire were strictly applied. There was a public official called a kasam, whose duty was to see to the proper distribution of legacies amongst the heirs. For this purpose, the authorities had to prepare inventories and valuations. The central and provincial archives preserve hundreds of thousands of inventories of possessions of deceased persons, extending all over the empire and continuing for hundreds of years. These provide a priceless indication of the range and growth of what we might call practical westernization, through the acquisition and possession of such Western products as clocks and watches, firearms, eyeglasses and telescopes, and even chairs. The figures of some 18th-century listings are revealing. Clocks and watches, 147. Pistols and muskets, 76. Textiles, 62. Chairs, 57. Binoculars and telescopes, 39. Glassware and flatware, 38. Mirrors, 33. Chests and drawers, 21. Eyeglasses, 12. Beds, 5. Books and maps, 5. Miscellaneous goods, 5. Total, 500. The process of conscious and deliberate modernization required, for the first time, closer and more sustained contact with Westerners, and obliged Middle Easterners in increasing numbers to learn previously despised European languages and even to endure periods of residence in European cities. These visitors were of several kinds. The first were diplomats. The reforming Sultan Selim III decided, as part of his program of modernizing reforms, to adopt the European practice of continuous diplomacy through resident missions. His first was established in London in 1793 and was followed by others in Vienna, Berlin, St. Petersburg, and Paris. The problems and difficulties confronted by these first Middle Eastern diplomats in Europe were in many respects the mirror image of those that had long faced their European counterparts in the East: how to perform their duties in a strange and alien society, nurtured on different scriptures and classics, inspired by different ideals and aspirations, and to encapsulate them all, speaking a different and, for most of them, totally unknown language, written in an unknown script. Their position was much more difficult than that of Europeans. These, as already noted, had a tradition of learning languages, scriptural, classical, and merely foreign. They had even been willing to undertake the study of more exotic languages. In the 16th and 17th centuries, chairs of Arabic were established in the major European universities. Later, Persian was added, but not Turkish. This being a modern language, it was, like English, French, German, etc., not seen as a subject for university study. But there were ample opportunities for Europeans to study Turkish outside the academic programs, and there was a considerable body of printed literature in European languages dealing with the history, culture, religion, and current conditions of the Islamic world. The European reader even had at his disposal a selection of Middle Eastern classical literature in translation. European Christians had a further advantage. They could also find help from the local communities of their Christian co-religionists, of whom there were many in Turkey, Egypt, Syria, and even as far east as Iraq and Iran. Except in North Africa, where Judaism lived on but Christianity died out, these communities continued to survive and even to flourish. An intense propaganda effort from Rome even persuaded significant segments of the Eastern churches to enter into communion with Rome, producing uniate communities of Greek, Armenian, and Arabic speech. Muslim visitors had no comparable recourse in Western Europe, where the Muslim communities had been expelled after the reconquest, and where no contact or recruitment was permitted. At first, Middle Eastern diplomats in Europe found the same answer as their Western colleagues, to make use of dragomans, who, initially employed as translators or interpreters, became far more than that, serving as intermediaries and sometimes as principals in major negotiations. The Turks in Europe, even more than the Europeans in Turkey, at first relied on these intermediaries. Much faster than their European colleagues, perhaps under far stronger compulsion, they made a determined effort to learn new languages and master new crafts. They did so with astonishing speed and success. The first experiment in regular diplomatic relations launched by Selim III ran into difficulties and was abandoned. But a new start was made in the 1830s, and thereafter, first Turks, then Persians, and then other Middle Eastern governments, as these came into existence, attained a high level of diplomatic skill and professionalism. At first, their numbers were very limited, and Middle Eastern governments soon became aware of the need for instruction in a variety of subjects, and more immediately, in the languages that provided access to these subjects. The practice, therefore, arose of sending students to study in Western countries. It is difficult for a Westerner to appreciate the magnitude of this change in a society accustomed to despise the infidel barbarians beyond the frontiers of civilization. Even traveling abroad was suspect. The idea of studying under infidel teachers was inconceivable. The question of learning from infidels arose at a relatively early date in connection with directly military matters. The story is told in the Turkish chronicles of a Venetian war galley that was cast ashore in a storm and abandoned by its crew. Ottoman naval specialists examined the hulk and found things that they thought it might be useful to adopt. But the religio-legal question arose: is it permissible to imitate the infidels? The answer of the religious authorities was that it is permissible to imitate the infidels in order to more effectively fight against them. The same argument was used in the 18th and early 19th centuries, when the ulema were again consulted on the lawfulness of the various westernizing reforms in the armed forces, and, more especially, the establishment of schools with European, not always converted, teachers, and European, not always translated, textbooks. A question often asked by the memorialists was, why is it that in the past we were always able to catch up with the new devices of the infidels, and now we are no longer able to do so? Interestingly, for a long time, they did not ask why it was always the infidels who introduced the new devices. When they did ask this question, something more than modernization, catching up, was involved. Adopting or copying infidel devices was one thing. Learning from infidel teachers was another. Actually going to infidel countries to learn was an even more radical change. Nevertheless, it had become necessary. First, the Pasha of Egypt, then the Sultan of Turkey, then the Shah of Persia, all sent selected groups of students to London, Paris, and elsewhere. At first, these students' missions were overwhelmingly military, and their purpose was to ferret out and master the secrets of Western warfare. But this involved learning Western languages, and these students found other, perhaps more interesting, reading matter besides their military manuals. For the first time, young Muslims from the Middle East were directly exposed to the impact of Western ideas. In the past, the barrier between the two civilizations was such that the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Scientific Revolution had been irrelevant and unknown in the Islamic Middle East. But the revolutions in France offered new ideas and new models. In earlier times, as a Turkish historian remarked, the scientific current had broken against the dikes of literature and jurisprudence. The enthusiastic and optimistic liberalism of the 19th century opened a sluice in the dike, through which first a trickle and then a flood of new ideas penetrated the hitherto closed Muslim elites. One unexpected result of the impact of these new ideas was the appearance of a third category of Middle Eastern visitors to the West, political refugees, those who had observed some Western practices, tried to apply them at home, and soon found it expedient to leave and go back, usually to London or Paris. But these too, after a period in exile, often returned home, sometimes as part of a change of regime and, more broadly, of outlook. The new approach to language study brought a major change in communication and became a key factor in the relations between the civilizations. Contact with the West was no longer filtered through foreigners and minorities, but was direct. This change became increasingly effective as ever larger numbers of Middle Eastern Muslims were involved in the process. A turning point in the process of change occurred in 1821 with the outbreak of the Greek insurrection, which became the Greek War of Independence. The last of the Greek Grand Dragomans, Stavraki Aristarchi, was charged, probably unjustly, with complicity with the rebels and executed. The Ottoman historians tell us that for a while, incoming correspondence piled up in the office with no one to read it. Then the problem was solved by bringing the chief instructor of the naval school, one Hossa Ishak Efendi, to take charge. Hossa Ishak Efendi, died 1834, was a Greek Jew who converted to Islam and was a pioneer in the translation of Western scientific literature into Turkish, a task for which he had to create an entire new vocabulary. After him, the Grand Dragomans and their staffs were Muslims, and the translation office became a major ladder to influence and power. What mattered now was knowing how to talk to and deal with Europeans, knowing what was going on in Europe. Most of the major Ottoman statesmen of the mid and late 19th century rose by that ladder, and not by the older ladders of the army, the bureaucracy, and the religious establishment. The impact of the language revolution was not limited to classrooms and chanceries. Translation made Western books accessible to Middle Eastern readers. Another device of modernization, the printing press, made them more readily available. With the crumbling of the language barrier, direct observation of the West was now possible, and an increased recognition and more intimate awareness of European wealth and strength. The question now was more specific. What is the source of this wealth and strength, the talisman of Western success? Traditional answers to such a question would have been in religious terms. All problems are, so to speak, ultimately religious, and all final answers are therefore religious. The final answers given by traditional writers to the older formulation of the question were always, "Let us go back to our roots, to the good old ways, to the true faith, to the Word of God." With that, of course, there was always the assumption that if things are going badly, we are being punished by God for having abandoned the true path. That argument loses cogency when it is the infidels who are benefiting from the change. Middle Easterners found it difficult to consider what we might call civilizational or cultural answers to this question. To preach a return to authentic, pristine Islam was one thing. To seek the answer in Christian ways or ideas was another, and, according to the notions of the time, self-evidently absurd. Muslims were accustomed to regard Christianity as an earlier, corrupted version of the true faith, of which Islam was the final perfection. One does not go forward by going backward. There must therefore be some circumstance other than religion or culture, which is part of religion, to account for the otherwise unaccountable superiority achieved by the Western world. A Westerner at the time, and many Muslims at the present day, might suggest science and the philosophy that sustains it. This view would not have occurred to those for whom philosophy was the handmaiden of theology, and science merely a collection of pieces of knowledge and of devices. Muslims had their own philosophy that had retained and perfected the heritage of the ancients under the aegis of Islam. They had also their own science, handed down by their own great scientists of the past. Instead, they looked for the secret of Western success in those features of the West that were most distinctive, most different from anything in their own experience, and not tainted with Christianity. The French Revolution, the first major movement of ideas in Europe that was not explicitly or implicitly Christian, and even projected itself in the East as anti-Christian, had seemed for a while to offer such a choice. But under the Empire and the Restoration, it lost this appeal. For the whole of the 19th and most of the 20th century, the search for the hidden talisman concentrated on two aspects of the West, economics and politics, or, to put it differently, wealth and power. The economy, and more especially industry, was seen as the prime source of wealth, and therefore ultimately of military effectiveness. Halet Efendi, who was the Ottoman ambassador in Paris from 1803 to 1806, observed, "If, as an emergency measure, once every 3 or 4 years, 25,000 purses of aspers, a silver coin, were to be set aside and 5 factories for snuff, paper, crystal, cloth, and porcelain, as well as a school for languages and geography set up, then in the course of 5 years, there will be as good as nothing left for them to hold on to, since the basis of all their current trade is in these 5 commodities. Hallett's version is somewhat crude. Later rulers and ministers, first in Egypt, then Turkey, then other countries in the region, adopted more sophisticated versions of what was basically the same approach, and tried to catch up with Europe by building factories, principally to equip and clothe their armies. The effort failed, and most of the early factories became derelict. Later attempts to catch up with the Industrial Revolution fared little better. Unlike the rising powers of Asia, most of which started from a lower economic base than the Middle East, the countries in the region still lag behind in investment, job creation, productivity, and therefore in exports and incomes. According to a World Bank estimate, the total exports of the Arab world, other than fossil fuels, amount to less than those of Finland, a country of 5 million inhabitants. Nor is much coming into the region by way of capital investment. On the contrary, wealthy Middle Easterners prefer to invest their capital abroad, in the developed world. The other immediately visible difference between Islam and the West was in politics, and more particularly in administration. Already in the 18th century, ambassadors to Berlin and Vienna, later to Paris and London, describe, with wonderment and sometimes with admiration, the functioning of an efficient bureaucratic administration in which appointment and promotion are by merit and qualification, rather than by patronage and favor, and recommend the adoption of something similar. The impact of Western example and Western ideas also brought new definitions of identity, and consequently new allegiances and aspirations. 2 ideas were especially important, both new in a culture where identity was basically religious and allegiance normally dynastic. The first was that of patriotism, coming from Western Europe, particularly from France and England, and favored by the younger Ottoman elites, who saw in an Ottoman patriotism a way of binding together the heterogeneous populations of the empire in a common love of country, expressed in a common allegiance to its ruler. The second, from Central and Eastern Europe, was nationalism, a more ethnic and linguistic definition of identity, the effect of which in the Ottoman political community was not to unify, but to divide and disrupt. The influence of Central and East European-style nationalism was vastly greater than that of West European-style patriotism, and even where patriotism was adopted, it was given a national rather than an empire-wide content. European patterns of identity and allegiance were alien to the peoples of the Middle East, but not equally so. The situation in a fragmented Germany and Italy, and in the polyglot Austrian and Russian empires, was much closer to Middle Eastern conditions, and the message that was brought, for example, by Hungarian and Polish refugees, was much more readily intelligible. After the events of 1848, a number of Hungarian refugees went to Turkey, and many of them stayed. Some learned Turkish, some became Muslims, and their role in the development of these new ideas in Turkey is considerable. The same is true, though to a lesser extent, of Poles, who also came to seek refuge. These ideas had powerful and contradictory impacts on the attitudes and expectations of the Ottoman population, and particularly the non-Muslim subject peoples. On the one hand, Ottoman patriotism and the new reforms appeared to offer them legal and civic equality with the previously dominant Muslims. At the same time, nationalism inspired the desire for separate national sovereignty, free from what they were increasingly beginning to regard as the oppressive Ottoman yoke. Both undermined the old consensus, which had enabled people of many different faiths and nations to live together in reasonable harmony under the supreme authority of the Sultan. All this happened at a time when the non-Muslim subjects, and more especially the Christians, were thriving mightily. There were several causes for this. One was better education. For obvious reasons, they had better opportunities to learn languages, travel, and receive Western schooling. The non-Muslims more than the Muslims, the Christians more than the Jews. For another, they enjoyed the patronage of the European powers. These again preferred non-Muslims to Muslims and Christians to Jews, in both respects reversing the traditional situation. And, of course, arising from these, the Ottoman Christians and Jews enjoyed the common minority advantage of their own networks of kinsfolk and co-religionists, especially abroad. The Muslims, on their side, were still inhibited by their old disdain for the infidels, and more particularly for traditional infidel occupations. Certain professions and occupation were regarded as Jewish, Greek, or Armenian, and therefore undignified for a Muslim or a Turk to follow. This sort of choice is not unfamiliar in other societies and other times. Perhaps for these reasons, most of the state-sponsored economic enterprises were unsuccessful, while the minorities and their foreign patrons increasingly controlled the economy. At a certain stage, one must rather say foreigners and their minority protégés. The changed relationship may be seen in a simple example, that traditional Middle Eastern indulgence, a cup of coffee. Coffee originally came from Ethiopia. It was brought up both shores of the Red Sea, through Arabia and Egypt, to Syria and to Turkey, and then exported to Europe. Sugar came from Persia and India. For a long time, both coffee and sugar were imports to Europe, either through or from the Middle East. But then the colonial powers found that they could grow coffee and sugar more abundantly.